Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Obamacare premium hikes become a political hot potato, but the reality may not be anywhere as dire as some pundits predict.
Most Americans, about 280 million Americans, this doesn't affect at all.
Also this week, with Florida a critical factor in national politics, Donald Trump includes the capital city on his Sunshine State itinerary, although some of his fans there are reluctant to publicly express their support.
You're called names. And we just kind of let that go.
We'll also preview some of the constitutional amendments up for a decision on the ballot and get some insights on the mood of the electorate at a time when voter cynicism is on the rise. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Open enrollment for Obamacare begins next month. State and federal officials are hoping more young and healthy enrollees will sign up. But that demographic has been slow to come on board. That's led to increasing concerns that the Affordable Care Act could soon become the Unaffordable Care Act. But Lynn Hatter reports health policy experts say tales of the impending death of the ACA are greatly exaggerated.
Additionally, 2016 will be continued change and instability with an uncertain future subsequent to the elections next month.
The Florida Health Insurance Advisory Council's Carol Lostabchuk recently uttered a word that gives businesses and health insurance companies fear: uncertainty. Yet, in her rundown of the effects of the Affordable Care Act in Florida, she had even more to say.
The individual policies, which had been previously a smaller, much smaller segment of the market, have now grown to become a much larger share of the overall market.
As far as the small group market goes, it has continued to decrease as enrollment has shifted to other types of coverage.
As far as loss ratios go, they did decrease in total from 2014 in both the individual and the small group market.
You know, it sounds to me like, you know, you've got a Department of Insurance that's really trying to navigate a troubling situation because of a relatively non-competitive marketplace in our state.
Florida State University College of Medicine Professor Les Beitch is Oklahoma's former health secretary. And all that technical jargon you just heard? Well, the bottom line is that when it comes to federally subsidized health plans, competition and choice is shrinking. 78% of Florida is covered by a single carrier for Obamacare plans. And Beitch says the Department of Insurance regulation is performing a balancing act.
You know, the Department of Insurance has to be sure that they're doing their part to make sure that the premiums that are being asked for are both affordable on the standpoint of consumers, but also that hit a price point for the carrier that they will be affordable but also profitable for the company.
Premiums for the ACA-backed Florida health plans are expected to rise by 19%. The national average is even higher. While the Affordable Care Act is not on the brink of certain death, it's certainly suffering from growing pains. The number of sick people who enrolled in federally subsidized plans was larger than expected, costing insurance companies more to treat them. Hence, premium increases. The ACA also took a hit last year when a program designed to insulate insurers from financial losses was nixed. Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio gets credit for that one. And now the law's emerging weaknesses are being exploited by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump.
As you know, it's just been announced that Americans are going to experience another massive double-digit spike in Obamacare premiums, including more than a 100% increase in the great state of Arizona. They're going up over 100%.
During a swing through Florida, Trump said he wants to repeal and replace the law. Meanwhile, Arizona's massive rate hikes are an outlier. Premiums in the ACA plans are expected to go up by an average of 25% nationwide. But the combination of sicker people, higher premiums, and fewer choices is causing whispers of a possible death spiral for the law. But its supporters say it's far from dead, just troubled. Subsidies consumers receive are poised to increase, and they could absorb most or all of the price increases for people making around $25,000 a year. But Affordable Care Act expert Jonathan Oberlander of the University of North Carolina says, with most things healthcare, there is a caveat.
The people who are unsubsidized in Florida and in other states, and people buying coverage off the exchange, they are going to feel it. Again, most Americans, about 280 million Americans, this doesn't affect at all.
Those making between $30,000 and $40,000 a year could feel a bigger hit, and those who make too much for federal subsidies will certainly feel the burn. Still, more people than ever now have health insurance. And while insurance companies complain of higher than expected losses, the loss ratios, how much they deliver in direct customer care versus profit, are beginning to come down. A recent Georgetown study reported 95% of children are now insured, a record high. Yet FSU Medical School professor Les Beitch says the ACA could be working better. And the key to it is the part of the law the U.S. Supreme Court deemed optional for states, Medicaid expansion.
This problem is exacerbated in part by the Affordable Care Act not being fully implemented, you know, as it was conceptualized. So not having Medicaid expansion in the southeastern United States places a lot of pressure on the few number of players in the marketplace. If you have Medicaid expansion, you know, there's a lot better opportunities to spread all these risks around.
Still, that's a long shot in a state like Florida, where repeated efforts to use federal money to expand Medicaid to more low and mid-income people have been shot down. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump is confident a silent majority of voters will propel him to the White House. As Jim Ash reports, Trump supporters in liberal-leaning Tallahassee say they're either paying the price for their views or keeping their presidential pick to themselves.
Call it the Trump factor. Since the Access Hollywood hot mic video surfaced, Trump supporters at the highest levels have distanced themselves from the brash billionaire. Governor Rick Scott heads a Trump super PAC, but Scott insists he's been too busy managing disasters to join Trump on the campaign trail. Scott is widely believed to be considering a U.S. Senate run.
June, July, August, September, October. We've had Pulse. We've had two hurricanes. We have Zika. So it's been an active time.
U.S. Senator Marco Rubio is another Trump supporter and conspicuous no-show at Trump's Florida rallies. Rubio and Scott have political careers at stake, but rank-and-file supporters in Tallahassee say they're getting their yard signs vandalized or even having bumper stickers torn from their cars. When asked to talk on the record, some declined to give their full names or say where they work. 20-year-old Florida State University student Emily Gallant said she's been shunned on Facebook.
A lot of my friends will make posts like, "If you support Donald Trump, please unfriend me on Facebook." And I keep my friends very close to me, and I would never ask them to unfriend me or lose a friendship just because of something that they believed in. I think that everyone can disagree and still be friends, but unfortunately, I feel like a lot of my friends can't do that.
Marianne Sabalik thinks Trump is the best choice to strengthen the military, so she felt a responsibility to attend his rally. Sabalik didn't mind giving her name, but wouldn't say where she works.
It hasn't cost me any friends, but I do keep it to myself because you're called names. and we just kind of let that go.
55-year-old disabled Air Force veteran Tony Super traveled from the Western Panhandle to a Tallahassee rally. He says he's lost more than 40 Facebook friends.
Just disagreeing with my comments or my viewpoints, and, you know, that's fine with me, you know. I'm one to speak my mind and my viewpoint, and if people are living in a fantasy world or something and don't see the truth that's out there, then you know, so be it.
Most of the Trump supporters say the healthy turnout in Tallahassee gives them hope that the polls, like the pundits who wrote Trump off from the beginning, are wrong. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida voters face several state constitutional amendments on this year's ballot. One, backed by investor-owned utilities, among others, involves solar energy.
But if all of a sudden everybody had solar didn't have to pay, you know, people who don't choose solar's rates are going to go up.
For the second time, there's a medical marijuana amendment on the Florida ballot.
The list of conditions for which somebody can get a recommendation does not have the obvious gaping loophole that the authors of the California proposition inserted.
Should disabled first responders and low-income seniors get a special property tax break? That question also faces Florida voters.
That would put first responders in that category in the same treatment as U.S. military veterans who are disabled from a wartime disability.
Along with a big choice of political candidates, Florida voters this election cycle will also be deciding a number of state constitutional amendments. Solar energy is again on Florida's ballot. Voters overwhelmingly approved a separate solar amendment last month, but this general election proposal is more controversial. Wilson Sayre with member station WLRN in Miami unpacks exactly what Amendment 1 would do.
40 solar panels line the top of David Rifkind's home in South Miami. His roof is angled perfectly to capture the most direct sun, but it helps with other things too.
In our case, it's mostly peacock poop that we have to wash off with the rainwater.
To understand Amendment 1, we have to go over a few basics of how solar panels like Rifkind's work. First, most people who have solar panels still need to get some of their power from utilities. They're still connected to the grid. The second thing you have to understand is what's called net metering. It's called that because there is a special kind of electrical meter involved. Rifkind's is attached to his garage, keeping track of what his solar panels produce and what he gets from Florida Power and Light.
There's the Dell number and then there's the receive number. So deliver is actually what they send to us and receive is what they get back from us.
During the day, the solar panels often produce so much electricity his family can't use it all. So it gets pushed onto the grid. He gets credited for that on his meter. His neighbor might use some of the electricity or someone a few houses down. But then the clouds roll in or the sun goes down, and the solar panels don't produce electricity. To keep the AC and fridge on, his house pulls electricity from the grid. And you can watch the meter go back and forth, pulling and pushing electricity.
Oh, and now it just shifted. So now we're just receiving a little bit more from them. Oh, no, you know why? Because it just got shady all of a sudden, that's why.
And this back and forth has financial implications.
The amount of electricity we do not have to purchase from the utility every year is equal to about 8% of the installed price of the solar panels.
So his investments in the panels will pay for itself in about 12 years. That's assuming the value of the solar power he contributes to the grid and the cost to be connected to the grid stay the same. Opponents of Amendment 1 are afraid those things could change if it passes. So what Amendment 1 actually says is that consumers who don't have solar panels won't be forced to subsidize the cost of the grid for those who do. To Screven Watson, that's just a logical protection. He's with Consumers for Smart Solar, which is behind the amendment. He says people who don't use solar shouldn't have to pay more for the upkeep of the grid.
The cost to do the maintenance, to do the repairs in storms, is all sort of, if you will, baked into our electric bill. But if all of a sudden everybody had solar didn't have to pay, you know, people who don't choose solar's rates are going to go up.
He says he wants more solar in the state, but not on the backs of people who can't afford it. But on the other side, people like Stephen Smith with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy say this amendment is just the utility companies pushing back on consumers who are reducing their dependency on utilities.
If you go in your home and you put in a more efficient refrigerator, a new LED light bulb, you're going to use less power. Now, does the utility have a right to say that you've got to continue to pay them even though you're not using as much? I don't think so.
The fact is, the amendment isn't specific about how people who use solar would have to help pay for the upkeep of the grid. Smith is worried there could be a fee for people like Rifkind to connect to the grid, or that the rate he gets paid to contribute energy might go down. And that could make solar less attractive to individuals and leave it in the hands of utility-built solar farms. Utilities are the main financial backers of the amendment. Supporter Screven Watson says that concern is unfounded.
I can't imagine a scenario where a cost like this would ever be prohibitive. I really don't.
To make the amendment stick, 60% of voters will need to cast their ballots in support of it in November. I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
Another issue making a return appearance on the Florida ballot is medical marijuana. The constitutional amendment in question would make it legal. A similar measure was narrowly defeated in 2014. Health News Florida's Abe Amaraya dispels some of the smoke that's swirling around Amendment 2.
12-year-old Christina Clark takes medical marijuana. Her mother, Annalisa Clark, uses it to treat the seizures her daughter has had since she was 3 months old. At her worst, Annalisa says,
she wasn't doing anything. She just literally laid on the couch and shook and twitched.
Annalisa says her daughter was locked in a fetal position. She couldn't hold her head up, swallow her own spit, or control her bodily functions. After trying 17 different pharmaceutical drugs, Annalisa turned to medical marijuana. Now, Christina Clark sits at a small table in the living room of her suburban Jacksonville home. She pulls toys out of a box, one by one, and plays. The drug Annalisa credits with keeping her daughter seizure-free for the last 8 weeks is a medical marijuana oil from Hungary, a small glass bottle with a rubber dropper at the top.
These are just everything she's ever been on. This is another one we've tried.
Oh, wow.
So this one you just do drops.
Annalisa keeps a note on her fridge with instructions on what to do if she's arrested. That's because full-strength medical marijuana is illegal in Florida. Amendment 2 is trying to change that, but opponents are sounding the alarm.
With Amendment 2, pot will be legally dispensed by bud tenders, not pharmacists. In pot shops, not pharmacies. No prescription needed.
They say Amendment 2 would be a de facto legalization of recreational marijuana. Among the amendment's detractors is Orange County Sheriff Jerry Demings. The issue is personal for him. His brother was addicted to heroin and cocaine and died in 1999 from an opioid overdose.
My brother first was introduced to an illegal substance, controlled substance, back in the late 60s. Marijuana was that substance, and that ultimately, I think, created the type of desire in him to experiment with other illegal substances.
Opponents like Demings worry Amendment 2 would make medical marijuana as easy to get as it is in California. That state legalized the drug for medical use in 1996. John Calkins is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University's Hines College. He's been studying drug policy for 25 years. He says Florida's proposal is more restrictive than California's law.
The list of conditions for which somebody can get a recommendation does not have the obvious gaping loophole that the authors of the California proposition inserted, likely intentionally, because they wanted to create such a loophole.
In California, patients can get medical marijuana if they say they have pain and anxiety. Florida's Amendment 2 would require a diagnosis of one of 10 conditions, things like cancer, epilepsy, HIV/AIDS, and multiple sclerosis. But would medical marijuana actually help a patient with those conditions? Dr. Igor Grant is the director of the Center for Medical Cannabis Research at the University of California, San Diego.
It is not true that cannabis has no value whatever and there's no science.
Grant says there's research to show medical marijuana is effective in treating four conditions: nerve pain, symptoms of multiple sclerosis, nausea, and low appetite.
It is also not true that it is a panacea and will cure everything. So it's, it's in between.
Backers and opponents have spent a total of more than $5 million to sway voters on Amendment 2. If it passes, the debate will likely shift to implementation. The amendment leaves a lot of those details up to the Florida Department of Health. I'm Abe Abaraya in Orlando.
Our final amendment overview is actually a doubleheader, as we hear from Jessica Palumbo at member station WJCT in Jacksonville. Amendments 3 and 5 would extend property tax breaks to disabled police and firefighters and low-income seniors.
In October of 2005, Orange County Sheriff's Deputy Adam Pierce was patrolling part of Orlando's Orange Blossom Trail.
It was a high-crime, high-drug area.
At age 25, Pierce was already a 6-year veteran of the force.
And I enjoyed working that area.
One Monday, he caught a drug dealer in the act, and the guy tried to flee. Another deputy shot the suspect with a taser in the right arm.
And as fate would have it, he was left-handed. And he had a gun in his left pocket. And we didn't know it. He was laying on the ground and started to get up like he was going to run. So I ran towards him to tackle him, basically. And he pulled out the gun. He turned around and fired twice.
The first bullet hit Pierce in the top of his head. The second tore through his neck and lungs before shattering one of his vertebrae. A decade later, he remains paralyzed from the waist down, with nerve damage shooting intense pain throughout his body. When that pain became too much to work recently, he retired from the Sheriff's Office Forensics Unit. He gets disability payments, but his family is on a pretty tight budget. If voters pass Amendment 3, the property tax bill on Pierce's home would disappear. That would save him roughly $4,200 a year, he says. And the exemption would go for all first responders permanently and totally disabled in the line of duty. Pierce and his wife, Crystal, know exactly how they would spend that extra money.
Food. We have 7 kids. And our food budget right now is $1,200 a month.
Central Florida Republican Representative Larry Metz sponsored the bill that got the Amendment 3 exemption on the ballot.
That would put first responders in that category in the same treatment as U.S. military veterans who are disabled from a wartime disability.
Metz says a disabled cop in his district, Raul Perez, contacted him with the idea. It passed the legislature unanimously.
And I think that's a great example of the process working just the way it was intended to work.
It's not clear how many first responders will qualify statewide because the legislature would have to clarify the definition of permanently and totally disabled. In Jacksonville's Duval County, property appraiser Jerry Holland estimates 50 police and firefighters would be in that special exempt group.
They're getting a freer ride, you know, than those who may not get any exemption at all.
He says the Amendment 3 exemption could take $125,000 in revenue away from his county, school district, and other taxing bodies. He calls that an insignificant amount. But on the other hand, it's on top of many tax breaks already on the books. Another proposal on the November ballot would expand one of those breaks for low-income seniors. They can already be exempted from property tax if they live in the same home for 25 years. Under Amendment 5, local governments could let them keep that exemption, even if their home's value rises above a current threshold of $250,000. Holland says as the exemptions add up, cities and counties can start to feel the squeeze.
They have to say, okay, do I spend as much money in this area of arts and parks and this over here? Or maybe eventually all these exemptions become straws on the camel's back.
Then, he says, they might decide to raise taxes. Legislative analysts say it's hard to estimate the total statewide cost of Amendments 3 and 5 because local governments and state lawmakers would have to take further action before they would take effect. I'm Jessica Palumbo in Jacksonville.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, the 2016 election has brought out some of the worst the American electorate has to offer. Bitter and vitriolic, the race has been marked by allegations of corruption from the presidential contest on down. Not surprisingly, Nick Evans reports it's testing Florida voters' already tenuous faith in the whole idea of government.
I wouldn't consider myself a Republican, per se, or a Democrat, per se. I think both parties are equally corrupt.
This is Eric Christensen, a junior finance major at Florida State University, and he's in line for an event with Milo Yiannopoulos at the school last month. The alt-right darling, known for incendiary rhetoric couched as an attack on political correctness, attracted hundreds like Christensen to hear his speech. He also drew some opponents. In line, most agree. Corruption is a big problem in government.
So it seems to me that we don't have people who are, you know, fighting for our rights in government, but instead fighting for the rights of businesses or foreign powers.
But yeah, I definitely think that the government's getting corrupt. It's just more corrupt every day. I mean, to answer that question, yes, it's a snowball effect.
It's going to be in any government, anywhere you have humans. It's just a human nature, corruption. Churches, governments, so... No way around it.
That's Will Leach, Hagen Gary, and Austin Cole. But across the way, the protesters feel about the same. Here's Bianca Balaji.
I can't trust the government anymore because I'm constantly being lied to by everyone, by Republicans, by Democrats. It's not a Democratic, it's not a Republican thing. It is Democrats and Republicans working together to fool the American people.
And while most focus their ire on the federal government, high-profile scandals among state officials this year have likely done little to allay voters' concerns. First, there was Jacksonville Democratic Congresswoman Corrine Brown, brought up on federal charges related to an allegedly bogus charity.
Half-truth witch hunt. Period. I know, bitch. No. Half-truths and witch hunt. I mean, there's a lot of questions. I don't have any questions.
And then Republican Attorney General Pam Bondi came under fire for accepting a donation from the Donald J. Trump Foundation shortly before deciding not to join a multi-state case against Trump University.
I had absolutely no idea, nor would I have had an idea, that there was one complaint. There was never an investigation open, nor was there ever a multi-state.
Both loudly proclaimed their innocence. But more recently, Jacksonville Democrat Reggie Fullwood dropped out of his state House race after pleading guilty to fraud charges. All the same, University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus says those examples aren't enough to call Florida's government corrupt.
You can't really say that per se. There are individuals in Florida state government that probably, and we know, have been accused of crimes and some have been convicted. How broad is it? We don't know.
It's awful easy to just cast with a broad brush all the politicians as being corrupt, simply because the actions of a very, very small percentage.
This is Jack Richardson. He's a retired firefighter who used to lobby on behalf of his profession in the Florida legislature.
And I met lots of lawmakers and staff people who I felt worked as hard as they could to do the best job that they could for the most people that they could.
And he says the best way to combat corruption is to keep it from cropping up in the first place.
I think if more John Q. Publics like me and others and yourself got involved in the process in a very personal way and saw their legislators at least once a year or spoke to them on the phone or wrote them a letter, that maybe the politicians would get the idea that the rest of us are watching and we're trying to pay attention. And when they don't get things done the way they should get things done, that there's a good chance that we won't bring them back into office.
The most recent figures from the Pew Research Center show only 1 in 5 Americans have faith in their government. In Florida, public disclosure, ethics, term limit, and fair redistricting measures have all been approved to fight corruption. But determined officials have found ways to circumvent all four, with differing levels of success. As voters head to the ballot box, it seems clear many are dissatisfied with the status quo. But the correct way to address those problems is far less certain. I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.